And now, another Secret Policeman's podcast brought to you by Amnesty International.
Steve Merchant here with the Mr. Chevy Chase. Now, Chevy, it's a long way to come to be involved with a charity like this. So what lured you across the pond?
My wife.
She was here in London, and so I got to track her down.
She wanted to go to Florence as your best friend. I felt honored to be asked by Amnesty International to be a part of this. And I remember the old Secret Policeman's Ball with Monty Python and Beyond the Fringe. But it's time we did it again. This is probably the most horrific time in my life of killing, needless killing in war, and et cetera, et cetera. And we all know that.
But people, I think some of the people who were involved in those classic policemen's balls often talk about the fact that they think that comedians and comic actors often have an affinity with Amnesty because they sort of understand the importance of freedom of speech and being able to query things and question things. Do you think there's some truth in that?
I think there's more than just truth in it. I think and know that a sense of humor is a sense of perspective, which means it's a sense of it's a way of gauging what is important and less important in life. And those who don't have a sense of humor, such as Bush, who has a sense of humor, an egg timer, they don't have the perspective, and therefore they make bad choices in life. And that's what we're living through right now.
Andrew Maxwell.
Women rule the world, there'll be no war! It'll be a very different kind of war. There'll be a whole lot less bombing and a lot more snide backstabbing. Military propaganda would be pictures of Saddam Hussein looking shit on his holidays in Heat magazine. Because that flabby arse dictator. Look at that stretch mark tyrant. Leave me alone, I had a big Christmas.
Well, I was just intrigued to talk about a little about comedy because I, in the UK, have been a TV writer and stuff, and now I'm just moving into performing. And as I understand it, you started life, which a lot of people don't realise, as a comedy writer for
I
a long
started,
time.
I started with a thing called in the 60s, right out of college, Channel 1 Underground Television, which one of the shows became Groove Tube, which became a movie. From there, I was writing for Mad Magazine, then the National Lampoon came to be, and I wrote for them. And I ended up writing for Alan King and various other TV shows, and then moved out to L.A. and wrote for the Smothers Brothers, Lily Tomlin and others. When I was writing for the Smothers, that's when I met Lorne Michaels.
Who was the producer of Saturday Night Live?
Who was just about to start it, and he was looking for writers. And I was in line waiting to see Holy Grail. A 12 o'clock show, a midnight show, the first one in L.A. And I guess I was cutting up in line or something with Rob Reiner or something, and who's not that funny, but I must have been saying some funny things because Lauren asked Rob who that guy is, and he said he's a writer. He writes for some others. And then I got a call saying, would you meet with Lorne Michaels at the Chateau Marmont? That's a hotel out there. And I met with him, and he asked me if I would be interested in writing for this new live show. And I said I'd absolutely be interested in writing for it. I'd been writing for 12 years and had a lot of Writers Guild Awards, and I was a good writer, and I felt very confident, and I really wanted to do live stuff out of New York, which is my hometown, really. And then I turned it down. I called him about 3 months later and said, is that job still open? And he said, you bet. And I went and I made $800 a week. And we were like brothers. I mean, the two of us really wrote half the show the first year. I mean, it's just unbelievable how hard we worked.
Mr. Eddie Izzard.
So, welcome to the whole stuff. And it's interesting, I've noticed we've now become in the computer world, which I'm very interested in toys and the computer thing, and we have seemed to have split into two parts. We have the PC world and we have the Mac world. The Mac people, the Macintosh with the Apple, they seem to be very groovy and colorful, and the PC people, numbers and stuff. But whenever we're loading up either one of these, we've got this very interesting thing. We load in this software, and it comes up as this thing says, do you agree that you've read all this stuff? Or do you disagree that you've read all this stuff? And we just go, I agree! I agree! We don't read a single fucking... I agree! We will take your children and shoot them out of cannons. I agree! Monkeys will take your buttocks. I agree! I agree! Because we've tried disagree... We tried that. Remember the early one? You disagree.
At the last minute, Lorne had, after we'd hired all these not ready for prime time players, they called them.
And that was Belushi, right? Was he also
John
on board that
Belushi,
side?
Gilda Radner, Danny Aykroyd,
yeah.
Jane Curtin, and good God. So Lorraine Newman, you know.
They thought, this is a good-looking guy. We should have him on the screen.
It wasn't that. It was suddenly, like a month before we were to go on the air, Lorne, he knew that I wrote a lot of political satire. He just said, let's have a screen test for television, just for the hell of it, with all of you guys. And we went down to a room in NBC, and everybody got on and did something, and that was fine. Then at the end, he said, Chevy, get up and do something. I said, what do you mean get up and do something? I'm not a stand-up. I don't know. He said, just get up and do something. So I made up a quick news story. You know, those ending stories that they ended the news with, the baby hippo was born today at the zoo. Yeah. And I ended it with, of course, unfortunately, the baby hippo stepped on the baby stork that was born last week. And now that's the news. Good night. And he loved it. And he said, you know, we ought to have a news thing, a news update, something close to the there. That was the week that was with yeah. David Frost years before, and you should be the guy. And I said okay, and I came up with these names like Rick Bulova, they were all names of watches. And he said, no, I don't want any Walter Crankcase jokes. You just say Chevy Chase. I'm Chevy Chase. You know, here's the news.
Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome the fabulous Dylan Moran.
British people have a huge and proud tradition of tolerance in everything, in your immigration policies and all that stuff. You freely let Polish people immigrate here in their hundreds and thousands you let all of the surgeons and astronauts and all the rest of them come over and let them clean your house twice a week for £35 and a digestive. And you see this in the way Britain conducted its empire, which you no longer have, of course. But it was very effective, that technique of walking around going, hello, hello, with that English smile, the one that looks like you have a dead oyster under your tongue. Hello, hello, how are you? Don't touch me, stay away, fuck off, leave me alone. And just walking into places saying, you fuck off, we're having tiffin for the next 400 years. And it was very effective. Everybody would just go, okay, we're off, thanks very much now, goodbye. And it took ages for people to go, actually, wait a minute, we live here.
Because there was a show on at the time called Saturday Night Live with Howard Cosell, which had also a group of three players, Bill Murray, his brother, and Christopher Guest, who would do sketches here and there. It was a sort of a comedy variety show with Howard Cosell. We couldn't call ourselves Saturday Night Live. We had to say NBC's Saturday Night. So the only way we could get off the idea that it was live was by having a cold opening in which somebody did something and then said live from New York at Saturday Night. I said, you know, I'll do some kind of funny fall every week or least at some point. And that's what it ended up being. I would do these falls, and I would do Weekend Update, and I'd be in some sketches. And somehow, again, the camera liked me, and the network liked me, and said, you know, we don't like the bees sketch. We don't want that anymore. So, of course, every week we put a bees sketch in.
I go and find pollen. And then they go and find pollen in a plant, and they put it in their knees! Intelligent design, follow this, someone came up with this. They put nectar in their knees, and then they say, that plant fancies you. You sprinkle some sherbet on me, and I'll... Intelligent design, don't worry, I'll tell you about it later. There's sherbet from that one, they fancy. Can I have your nectar? I'm making honey for bears. Don't fucking ask.
Pardon me, Chippy, my phone's going.
That's all right.
It's my date for tonight. I just don't want to...
No.
Do you know what I mean? It's just, it would be bad to sort of hang around. I mean,
absolutely,
you know, I've wanted to meet you for, you know, 10 years, but, you know, this woman...
No, talk
I've known for 3 years.
Talk to him.
Hello. Hello there, how's it going?
Okay, let's pick it.
Hi, I'm just interviewing Chevy Chase now. It's kind of a slightly awkward moment. If you could have got here, I mean, I did say get here at 7:15, you've got here like 10 minutes before, which has kind of really ruined a lot of people's...
Ruined my day.
Yeah, that's Chevy there. Chevy's really annoyed. He was kind of really enjoying that interview. Do you need me to come up there and help you get in, or can you get in? Okay, I'll be up there shortly. All right, cheers, bye.
Anything else?
That's the
story of my life. Basically, I became extremely famous very fast within a few shows. And the only way I knew that was because I got up very early and I was a head writer, and I made my way to NBC from my apartment by walking. And I would hear after a while, a few months... And it meant people were going Chevy Chase.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I could see eyes looking at me. But we did 3 shows a month, and I'd go out on that fourth show that was a rerun. I'd go out to L.A. to visit my girlfriend, who I wanted to marry. It's why I left the show after 1 year. And I was out there, we went to Jack Nicholson's house, just because I happened to know Jack. And I went in there, and all of these huge movie stars were in there, and they were in hysterics at the TV and going shh, shh, shh. It was a Saturday night, and they were doing a rerun of a Saturday Night Live, which they do on the fourth week, and it was me they were laughing at, and that's how I knew I had become famous.
How do you feel about the rise of China? Give me a home about how you feel about the rise of China. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Rise of China. You know? I know the Chinese People's Party, you know, the communists, they're evil. But it's just nice to have a pick of evil. You know, I grew up in the 90s, man. All it was masturbation and nirvana for me. You know? But now we've got a pick of empires again. Nice to have a pick, isn't it? Isn't it, though? America or China. We've got a pick again. I'm not saying either of them are good. It's just nice to have a pick. You know, America can put a man on the moon, but China can knock out 20 pairs of socks to the pound. Just depends what you want out of life. I want a lot of socks. When I'm stumbling around in the morning, I'm not looking for lunar landings.
And how did you deal with that celebrity when it happens that quick? Did it? Were you a crazed egomaniac, or were you back?
You know,
did you go into the show?
Probably a crazed egomaniac. I mean, the first thing I said to myself was, "Look, I'm already 32. I've been writing for years. I should have perspective on this, and I do. And I felt that I did. And of course, you don't until many years later when you have retrospective on it."
The only remaining empire in the world really is America, I suppose. And their technique is very different, because what they do is they go to some war-torn, fucked-up, strife-riven place and have a nosy around for chocolate or oil or whatever it is they require at the time. And people meet there where the Americans have gone, and the locals meet, and they get pissed off, and they meet in the local bombed-out cafe, and they go, what are we going to do? I'm doing a pan-global accent because it saves time, okay, and America gets around. They go, what are we... And this represents poverty. What are we going to do, hey, about the imperialistic fucking Yankee pig dog who come over here and they look at our shit? You, hey, I'm talking to you. Put down the beans. What are we going to do? It's kind of Chinese Al Pacino from Brooklyn people... And then what America does is very, very gradually, it builds a Starbucks around these people. And they all get addicted to latte, and it saps their will to rebel. America is sort of, it gets a very bad press at the moment because of the way it conducts itself. It's sort of seen as the bad flatmate of the world. Somebody who comes in and says, oh, sorry, did I break all your shit? Sorry about that. Was it yours?
Because, you know, so many of your SNL contemporaries, particularly Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, have since recently gone on to the, as it were, the more serious films, the meditative films like Lost in Translation. So, and I think there's lots of fans like me who would love to see
Danny
you doing
do
something.
Anything, believe me. I can't give him a lot of credit for that. All they had to do was just say his lines. I mean,
sure.
I love Bill. He says he's very funny, you know. But
I think we're surprised as fans that you've not done the same thing and that you've not
I've been basically retired in order to get my three daughters through puberty and adolescence and all that for 10 years or so, and I've started coming back again after doing an independent film, which will be out in January, and just finished doing Law and Order, a dramatic role as Mel Gibson being arrested and calling everybody a Jew. And,
so you're
but it's also a murder mystery kind of thing, and it's my first dramatic role, and I really enjoyed doing it. But it's really dramatic.
That's exciting, as I say, for fans. That would be. So you're playing Mel Gibson, or a version, a type of star like that.
It's pretty obvious.
Because you doing Mel Gibson would be extreme.
Pretty obviously stricken from the headlines. But yes, and Mel's a good friend of mine. I wouldn't be imitating him.
Yeah.
But they obviously dragged it from the very latest headlines.
Well, let me say, I'm really looking forward to that and all your future work. So it's such a thrill to meet you. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah, and it's great to meet you. And good luck tonight.
And you.
Thanks.
You ever thought the effort that must be put in there? How baffling we must look to them. We know what they're about. They hate us. And they believe in some very narrow things. But what the hell do we believe in? What do we believe in? What do you believe in? Father Christmas, a fat, mythical man. The Tooth Fairy, again, your mother. Imagine being a fundamentalist terrorist looking at this now going, okay, just taking notes, these people are weird. I don't know what to say to you, ladies and gentlemen, so why don't we do this? This is meant to be for Amnesty. On a count of three, I want you all to shout out in one word what you believe in. Nobody will hear what you say. It'll all get roared, but you'll get to say it for once, man. On a count of three. Everybody. Are you with me? Home if you're with me. All right, let's do this. On a count of three. One, two, three. SpongeBob! SpongeBob SquarePants!
Tune in to Channel 4 on the 31st of October at 10 p.m. to watch The Secret Policeman's Ball.
Amnesty International's Secret Policeman's Ball. For more podcasts, visit www.secretpoliceman.com. We'll be right back.